This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of June 4th, here are a few top stories. In the news, Phoenix leaders unanimously approved new fines against people who solicit prostitution. As KJZZ's Christina Estes reports, the money is meant to help victims of sex and human trafficking.
First-time offenders still have the option of going to what's often called John School, a day-long diversion program, instead of jail. But those convicted two or more times will face fines between $2,000 and $2,500. Councilman Jim Waring.
We want to make this the most unpleasant place to get caught engaging in this just horrendous activity.
But resident Sean Severett told council members Phoenix should legalize and tax prostitution.
By doing so, we will make it a safe and regulated industry in which sex workers can feel safe to report crimes to the appropriate authorities.
While he called prostitution a victimless crime, the council unanimously approved the fines, which will go toward the city's new anti-human trafficking fund to benefit Starfish Place, a long-term housing project for victims of trafficking. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger.
In the 1970s, Ina Mae Gaskin and her philosophy of midwifery created a new awareness about natural birth in the U.S. It was in response to the over-medicalized practice that she thought birth in America had become. Today, that idea of having a natural or unmedicated birth is on the rise again as hospitals adopt midwife units and birthing centers and home births gain popularity among certain cadres of women. Now there are countless Instagram accounts showcasing these modern-day earth mamas. There's a new cottage industry for birth photographers and doulas, all promoting, it seems, the right way to give birth. At the same time, so has grown the idea of ecstatic birth and the idea that birth should be a beautiful experience for women. But according to our next guest, those ideas are setting up unrealistic expectations for new moms and shaping the way we think about motherhood today. Kate Rossiter is an associate professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, and she studies this idea of ecstatic birth. I spoke with her more about it and how her own birth shaped the work she does today.
So ecstatic birth, when I'm writing about it, it can mean a number of things. It can mean basically a birthing experience that is deeply pleasurable. Some women and some people who think about this talk about it as actually experiencing physiological orgasm during birth, which does sometimes happen for some women. Others really are thinking about it more as this kind of very deeply pleasurable, often spiritual experience that comes along with birthing. And the place that that gets really complicated for me is the idea that in order to mother well, you have to have an ecstatic birth. You have to enjoy this birthing experience and find it deeply pleasurable. And that really tripped me up in my own life quite badly, actually.
Yeah. So it's this idea of having a natural birth, quote unquote, versus a medicalized birth or getting an epidural or something like that, or being an earth mother.
You know, and I have to say, I really support women's choice around birth and birthing. I am not someone who believes that birth should or has to be medicalized. That's not it at all. But yes, the idea that birth needs to be a certain thing, a certain way, and sort of one of the new facets of, I think, the mommy wars is birthing correctly, birthing naturally without an epidural, as you say, you know, and that birth needs to look a certain way in order to set your course for motherhood. And I think for many women that's really profoundly limiting and very alienating.
Yeah. So I know I couldn't relate to that having had a baby last year. I definitely felt that. Tell us a little bit about your own experience and how this experience shaped what you're working on now.
Yeah. So my first baby, I was kind of type A about the whole thing and read all the things that I could possibly read and did all the things that I thought I should be doing to do this experience right and to do it well. And I plan to have a natural birth in Ontario where I live. Midwives are quite integrated into the healthcare system and midwives offer home births. And I had done a lot of reading about birth and thought that home birth would be my route to having this kind of wonderful, lovely birthing experience. And when it actually came time, my birth experience wasn't like that at all. I was very overdue. I was exhausted. My labor was really long. I felt overwhelmed. I felt really terrified, actually. I felt very scared and overwhelmed. And in hindsight, I would have been better, I think, to have gone to the hospital, had an epidural, had a nap, gone back into the sort of laboring process, that I think would have been better for me. But my mindset was so much fixated on doing this birth the right way that it became really hard to kind of see the forest for the trees. I was fixated on having a particular kind of birth.
Yeah.
My baby was born very healthy in all respects. It was a great birth. She was whole and healthy, and I was whole and healthy. That's what you want. But my emotional experience of the birth was quite different.
It wasn't this euphoric experience.
Yeah. And again, that sounds like such an awful thing to say. But I think when I kind of reflected back, I was actually quite undone by how much that experience didn't line up with what I had expected to happen. And the kind of profundity of my disappointment. And I think that disappointment wasn't just a kind of, like, you know, you're being narcissistic. I think that disappointment actually felt more nerve-wracking than that, because I felt like, oh, if I didn't get birth right, I'm off on the wrong foot to motherhood. I was supposed to love this. I was supposed to feel this wonderful thing, and I didn't. And what does that mean about me as a mom? And what I actually needed was for someone to say, yeah, sometimes birth is terrible, but you got through it and you're whole and she's whole and well done.
Yeah.
Because that's a really hard thing to do.
So how much of this do you think has to do with sort of the celebrity around this? Like, you've got the business of being born, and now there's this world around getting a doula. And like, there's a podcast I listened to the entire time I was pregnant called The Birth Hour, where you hear other women's birth stories. Mm-hmm. There's this whole industry sprouting up around birth photography and videos of your birth and like sharing that on social media. How is all of that shaping this?
Oh yeah, I think hugely. Like, I remember I hear myself and I just shudder because it sounds so narcissistic, and it is narcissistic, but I remember getting my haircut when I was, you know, 9 months pregnant and huge, and it was a terrible haircut. And I came home and I cried because I thought, God, I'm going to look awful in my birth shots. Now, the reality is that my birth shots, I look like I've been beaten around the face, and my daughter looks like she's been beaten around the face. We're exhausted. There's no amount of good hair that would have fixed how tired and overwhelmed I look in my birth shots. But yeah, I think there was this really real sense of the kind of performance of good motherhood and loving it and it being this, you know, joyful experience that meets all of your spiritual needs. Well, you know, actually, my experience is that birth and motherhood since then has been complicated and at times unbelievably beautiful and at times really, really hard. And, you know, kind of all of the biggest emotions rolled together. I felt let down by the idea that it was going to be all ecstasy all the time.
Yeah. So you say that this movement has sort of the patina of feminism, but it's actually, you say, feminism in the age of narcissism. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah. And I don't, you know, again, I don't want to come down on individual women for, you know, how they choose to birth. But, you know, I think it's a sort of a celebration of a kind of image of motherhood that actually is really constraining. And I think it's the kind of sense that if you, you know, that motherhood is now a way to perform yourself in certain ways. And in actuality, when you peel that back, what we have, I think, are moms who are really struggling, moms who more and more are finding themselves torn between being at work and in the home and trying to make the best decisions they can about those pieces, mm-hmm. or single moms struggling with that, and families who are not really supported in community because we've really eroded what it means to live in community with, you know, lots of grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles and people around. I think that's become more and more eroded.
Yeah.
And I think the work of parenthood is actually really hard right now, and we owe it to ourselves not to understand it as a kind of performative contest or, you know, another way to feel gratification and joy, but to understand it as the really hard work of growing people.
All right. Kate Rossiter, Associate Professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. Thank you so much for joining us to talk to us about this.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In science news, water is a precious commodity, especially in the desert. Valley cities rely on surface water infrastructure like dams and reservoirs, but a near-record low snowpack melted into those rivers this year. So water managers are looking to bank their supplies underground. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports.
In a helicopter flying over the Bartlett Reservoir in Tonto National Forest, Salt River Project surface water manager Charlie Esther admires the beauty of the glittering blue lake surrounded by the rocky desert forest.
Bartlett is one of my favorite locations. I just love the terrain around it, and it's just a great reservoir.
Even after 35 years of working with the Salt and Verity, Esther is still wowed by the water tableau the rivers have carved into the red desert landscape and the dams humans have chiseled into the picture.
The dam's really well behaved as well. It always performs well in a flood event.
Lately, though, Esther has dealt more with dry years as Arizona marches into its 18th year of drought. 2018 saw a near-record low snowpack, which means near-record low runoff. Only about 100,000 acre-feet of water. Compare that to 1 million acre-feet the year before, an outlier in a record 6 years of consecutive dry winters.
That's not only the first time in our historical record, but that never showed up in the tree ring record as well. So in over 800 years, that's the first time there were 6 dry years in a row.
An acre-foot can be hard to imagine. It's a measure of how much water would be needed to flood 1 acre of land to a 1 foot depth. And hardly any acre feet trickled into Bartlett Lake this year.
You'll see that it's down quite a bit. Its capacity today is 45%.
Not great, but not worrying yet. That's because SRP augments those low runoff years by pumping groundwater. Keep flying southwest from Payson in the helicopter, follow the Snaking Canal, and you get back to Phoenix, which gets almost 60% of its water supply from SRP. Catherine Sorensen helps manage it from City Hall.
It is really important that we are prepared for every scenario, including worst-case scenarios, because the consequences of failure are just too great.
After a sweeping measure to manage groundwater here in 1980, cities invested hundreds of millions of dollars for surface water treatment. That's helped recharge the Valley Aquifer. SRP and Phoenix, as well as several other cities, have pumped more than 1 million acre-feet back into the aquifer through the Granite Reef Underground Storage Project, or GRUSP.
Recharge has been a cornerstone of drought preparation here in the Valley, and it will continue to be in the future.
Think of water supply options as bank accounts. Reservoirs are like checking accounts. City water is available immediately and easily. Underground recharge is like a savings account. Cities take their extra surface water and put it in the ground to withdraw later. This future use will be especially important when surface water, most likely from the Colorado River in the west, is restricted. Some call aquifer recharge the dams of the future. Some, like Krista McJunkin, who manages GRUSP for SRP.
They have been. It's critical that we still have flexible use of our existing reservoirs, but you have to have underground storage because it offers unique benefits.
Benefits like no evaporation, and the geology that makes a good site for groundwater recharging rests in its composition. GRUSP, the state's largest recharge site, is on an ancient riverbed. The rocks and soil are perfect for water soaking. What remains to be seen is where other sites could be.
As urbanization happens, you don't want the best place for a recharge project to be a shopping mall.
And with water supplies banked for years, Central Arizona water managers are optimistic the taps are in little danger of running dry anytime soon. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This story is part of Elemental, a new public media collaboration covering sustainability in the West. From a business desk, Flagstaff is the first city in Arizona to stop recycling certain plastics. Other U.S. cities are doing the same, and some recycling plants are closing down. All of this is because China has drastically reduced what material it will import from the U.S. That means plastic and paper, once recycled, are now headed to the landfill. KJZZ's Heather Van Blocklin reports.
June 3rd was the first Sunday in Flagstaff's farmers market history where recyclables were consciously being thrown in the trash.
Hey, Jill. How are you, my dear?
Good.
Art Babbitt is a county supervisor and started the market almost 2 decades ago.
All those cups now are going to the landfill. All those plastic clamshells are now going to the landfill. They are not going to be allowed to be in the recycling stream anymore because of these changing realities.
The changing reality is China's new import ban placed on most U.S. recyclables. Tom and Lindsay Dietrich shop at the farmers market.
Strawberries and blueberries, they come, and leafy greens, come in these things called like a clam shell. our recycling center is not taking them anymore.
Americans recycle about 66 million tons of material each year, according to the EPA. About one-third of that gets exported to process and has mostly gone to China. But all that is changing, and Tom Dietrich doesn't fault China for their policy change.
I think that overall it's probably a good thing. If our previous policy was reliant on China being willing to trash their environment to take our stuff, and now they're pushing back against it and in order to make their place better, then good.
Across the U.S., recycling gets picked up and sorted at a municipal facility. The finished bales of plastics and paper are then sold to processors. China has processed roughly half the world's plastic and paper recyclables for over a decade. But last summer, it announced new standards on how much trash can be in the trash. It's called contamination rate, and it's a measure of how much non-recyclable material can be in paper and plastic bales. The new policy limits that rate to almost zero, at 0.5%. Stacy Hetmansperger is a plant manager in Phoenix.
Paper conveyor. This is about to go to the baler to be baled into the paper commodity. But you can see, like, there's pieces of plastic. It's not a perfect system. So you can kind of get a sense of why contamination is a challenge. Oh, see the plastic bags?
And while American recycling plants are adjusting to sort and ship a cleaner product, China has added to its list of material restrictions. China's original import ban filed with the World Trade Organization last July covered 24 materials. In April, China added 32 more products to the list. David Biederman is executive director and CEO of Solid Waste Association of North America.
And what China is saying is we no longer want to be the recipient of all this material, partially because the material isn't always clean. There's a substantial amount of contamination or garbage mixed in with the recyclables. But also, we believe, because China has a newfound interest in protecting the environment. Its own environment.
Joe Judice is Assistant Public Works Director in Phoenix.
We definitely have been impacted, and the impact for us has been that our plants operators need to be a lot pickier about the quality of the materials that they're making for sale, and in doing so, less materials making it into the sold market than it used to.
Western cities have been hit especially hard as they use ports to process almost exclusively in China. Blaine County, Idaho, cut its paper recycling program in May. Colorado, Nevada, and Alaska also have city-shrinking recycling programs, or in some cases, closing down plants altogether because they cannot meet China's new standard.
You know, the short-term reactions are hard to accept in the market where we want to recycle. We all want to recycle materials, and it's hard to hear that plants are having to close down.
For Joe and the Phoenix recycling facilities, the solution is to build processors nearby instead of shipping to China.
Like, for example, in Snowflake, Arizona, there was a mill that would buy recycled paper and remanufacture paper, but that mill closed down.
Joe is in the process of issuing a request for proposal to get a manufacturer to process recyclables in Phoenix. But that takes time. In the meantime, in Phoenix, Flagstaff, and a growing number of U.S. cities, recyclables are going to a landfill. Heather Van Blockland, KJZZ News.
And you're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, at a time when many families are hitting the road to visit national parks, a report out on Wednesday calls on the Trump administration to drop any plans that would allow uranium mining outside Grand Canyon National Park. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Last year, President Donald Trump issued an executive order calling on federal agencies to explore options for increasing energy production. The Department of Agriculture recommended reopening land adjacent to the national park to new mining. That would end the Obama administration's 20-year ban on new mining claims on 1 million acres of land. Steve Blackledge is a spokesman for Environment America Research and Policy Center, which issued the report.
Uranium mining has always been one of the riskiest industrial activities in the world. And so many people, 40 million Americans, get their drinking water from the Colorado River. And so it would just be, it would be folly to expand uranium mining and threaten that.
The report points to a study by the U.S. Geological Survey that found 15 springs and 5 wells near Grand Canyon contain uranium concentrations above the safe limit for drinking water. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And finally, in education news. From the show, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
The Invest in Ed campaign, which aims to get a measure on the November ballot that would raise the income tax of higher earners in Arizona, has released new polling indicating it's a popular concept among nearly two-thirds of the state's voters. The effort will need 150,642 valid signatures to make the ballot. At an event yesterday, the group wouldn't disclose how many signatures they'd collected. Joining me with a progress report is Joshua Buckley. He's a Mesa teacher and chair of the Invest in Ed initiative. Josh, how's the effort going at this point? You've got about a month to go to collect the needed signatures.
So right now, we've got a lot of that support that was generated during the Red for Ed movement. We've got a lot of teachers and educators and, you know, community members who are ready to do some work and get some funding for schools. And so we're in the process of getting out there. We just released some poll numbers yesterday that show that Arizona voters, two-thirds of Arizona voters support the initiative with the polling that we did. So right now we're just collecting signatures. You know, we think that we're on track to get it done by July. We're just, you know, we've got events happening every weekend and sort of organically people are hosting stuff during the week and doing all sorts of stuff to gather signatures. So we're excited about, you know, the organic and sort of ground up movement that's gathering signatures out there for the initiative.
Let's go inside the numbers a little bit if we can, yeah. Because definitely there is support based on the survey that was released. Can you give me an idea of how specific the question was? Was it, hey, do you support more funding for education, or was it specifically about raising this particular tax?
There were very specific questions on the actual income tax initiative, and then there was we even worked with some negative messaging in there to see if the support held, you know, and used the, you know, sort of the opposition messaging about it. And the support for it held even after we tried the opposition messaging on it, still have support even after kind of going through sort of negative messaging around it and sort of some of the issues that we think will pop up when we, you know, once it gets on the ballot, you know, some of the things that we think we're going to face. And so despite that, what we've seen is that people through the poll believe that more needs to be done. They're very aware of what happened in the legislative session and what the governor and the legislative body passed. But they still believe that more needs to be done for education funding. And like I said, two-thirds support this initiative, the exact initiative, not just supporting funding for schools, but the exact initiative that we're working on.
Now, that's an interesting point you make, because I think there may be some who think that as we hear about some of these school districts that have, in fact, raised salaries for teachers, based on the Red for Ed movement, it was about a lot more than just teacher pay raise.
Right. And I think that's what people are seeing. I mean, the governor... When Red for Ed came out and said, these are the things we want, the governor put his focus right away on teacher salaries, but didn't truly address sort of the funding needs in our classroom when it comes to, you know, building repair and curriculum needs and outdated textbooks and broken desks, all those sorts of things. You know, as a classroom teacher, you know, I am happy that my district was able to take the funds that the legislative body pushed over. They had to do some maneuvering and pulling from some different areas to make sure that in Mesa, every educator, not just classroom teachers, but everyone who's considered a certificated employee is going to be getting this 10% raise in Mesa. But they had to be creative with where that money's coming from. It wasn't all from the dollars put forward by the governor. And I think people know that school funding is about more than teacher salaries, and it was from us. And I think that they see that just because you raise teacher salaries doesn't mean that desks are going to be, you know, fixed, and it doesn't mean that we're going to get new textbooks. And so people see that need there still.
Now, you've heard the conventional wisdom narrative that people are more willing to support a sales tax hike than an income tax hike on a limited number of people. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's a misguided narrative?
Well, I think the problem that we have with the sales tax is that we are so sales tax heavy in Arizona. We have, you know, I think I don't want to say where we're at, but I know we're high in per state. I think it might be 11 or 10 where we're at as sales tax wise. So we have a high sales tax, and the issue is that when we raise sales taxes, so many of our rural municipalities and our cities use sales taxes to fund what they do, whether it's police and fire and safety. And so if we go out for a sales tax, it makes it harder for cities to go out for a sales tax and do the things they need to do on top of it. So some areas will have over, you know, a 10%, a double digit sales tax, because that's how we fund stuff in Arizona. And we've continually relied on a sales tax And we just don't think that that's the best way to do it. We don't think that that's the right way to fund schools. I mean, this is only a piece of the puzzle for funding education that we're asking to do through this income tax. Right now, a lot of what goes into the general fund that funds education comes out of sales taxes. So we're just trying to diversify where those funds for schools come from.
Joshua Buckley is a government economics teacher. He's also chair of the Invest in Ed campaign. Josh, thanks for the time this morning.
Hey, thank you so much.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.